Okay, we got through four verses yesterday. It's a great pace since we were supposed to get through 17. but we're going to catch up today, maybe. We're going to try. We talked about the man with leprosy, and what we did is we started off 12 miracle events that will occur in chapters 8 and 9. But what I want to show today is, actually I'll do this now instead of at the end of the next lecture, at the beginning of the next one, is that we have this interrelationship between word and deed. Jesus has just talked in the Sermon on the Mount. He's just talked in the Sermon on the Mount in chapters 5 through 7, exerting authority through his words. Then what you find is you find four miracle events that occur after validating, in a sense, his words. So you have deeds that are validating the authority he exerted through his words. Does that make sense? Does that make sense, what I'm saying? The first four miracles are validating what he's just said here. And the reason why I split it into the first four from the last eight is because right here we have another exertion of authority through word. What you have, I believe it's 8:18 through 22. Yeah. 8:18 through 22 is Jesus speaks once again, but this time he's talking about the cost of what it means to follow him. That the allegiance he demands, I'm going to put cost of following, the allegiance he demands is going to be one that challenges the general sociological understanding of what is honorable and what is shameful. And what Jesus says is that in my new kingdom, I'm delivering an entire new program that redefines what it means to be honorable, that redefines what it means to be a kingdom. So he exerts his authority once again in word right in the middle of these miracles. And then what you have is you have four more miracles, deeds, that are validating this exertion of authority. So you see, there's an interrelationship between words, deeds. And then once again, right here, we have another exertion through words. This time it comes in the description of fasting in chapter 9, 14 through 17. So chapter 9, 14 through 17, he's challenged about fasting, and he makes a statement not so much about fasting, but about the kingdom and about who he is. For the bridegroom, there's no reason to fast and mourn when the bridegroom is still present. So he exerts that he is the bridegroom that has come to deliver the king. Once again, exerting some major authority language through words. I'm just going to put bridegroom talk. This authority through word then is followed by four miracles, four deeds that are validating or legitimating his exertion of authority through his word. You see how this is interplaying? So we have words spoken in the Sermon on the Mount exerting major authority. You've heard that it was said, but I say to you. And the chapter 7, verses 28 through 29, the crowds were amazed because he spoke with such great authority, unlike any of the other teachers of the law. He exerts authority through word. That is validated by the next four miracle accounts because the words and the deeds are interrelated. They are symbiotic in the relationship. You can say all that you want, but what are the deeds that back up what you're saying? Same thing happens here. He exerts his authority through word at the cost of following him. And that is validated by the next four miracle events. He exerts his authority once again with bridegroom talk, validated by four miracle events. You see how this is working? Word indeed. Does he have the authority to say what he is saying? Does he have the authority to say what he is saying? To claim what he is claiming? To establish a kingdom? Does he have that authority? And what the miracles are doing is they're saying, yes, he does. They're saying, yes, he has this authority. Who else has the authority to do things like this? And we'll actually see this in a relationship coming up as a major point of tension when we get to the Beelzebub controversy in chapter 12. Because again, they're asking, by what authority do you do these deeds? And they say it's by the prince of demons. He says that's ludicrous, but we'll get there later. Okay, everybody following with me on this? Very important. This is what the whole chapters 8 and 9 are all about. Does he have the authority to say what he's just said, that I'm establishing a kingdom? Okay. We dealt with the man with leprosy yesterday, which was a pretty astounding moment, especially for the kingdom of the Jews. Because this man with leprosy is breaking all of the rituals, breaking, even putting their entire community in danger by coming amongst the large crowd into Jesus. And Jesus reaches out and touches him, and then he heals him. So, it's one of those things like, and this is going to sound stupid, but I'm thinking, okay, if he touches him, is he unclean? Because when he touches him, he heals him. So like, what does that mean? You know what I mean by that? Like, if you touch a leper, then you're unclean. But whenever you touch him to heal him, does that... Anyway, it doesn't matter. I just think that's interesting. Verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, why is that significant? Exactly. Jesus shifted the base of operations from Nazareth to Capernaum. Capernaum is the place where his whole ministry in Galilee will be launched from. So when he comes back to Capernaum, because he was at a different place with the Sermon on the Mount, when he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. What is significant about that? He is a centurion. What is a centurion? A leader of at least 100 soldiers, at least. Hence the name cent, centurion, centurion, century, 100. Centurion, but he's not just a leader of 100 soldiers. What are the soldiers a part of? The Roman army. You have the kingdom of Rome coming to the kingdom of God, where most of the time a Jew would think what would happen in that moment. Major conflict. But what happens here? The centurion comes asking for help. That is weird. That would not just offend the Jew. Well, that would offend the Roman Empire. Why would the centurion, the leader of the most powerful army in the world, have to come to one of the subjects of their kingdom for help? Very strange. A centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. What is weird about that verse?
Lord.
Now, hear me very clearly. The word kurios, and here it's in the vocative, so it'd be kurie. The word Lord does not necessarily mean king. Not necessarily mean king. The word for kurios can mean king. You guys know what I mean whenever I'm saying the word kurios? Very important word, kurios. The word kurios can mean king. It is translated Lord. But it can also mean like sir. It can also mean saying, you know, a Mr. Jesus. You know, Sir Jesus. So don't immediately think that he's saying that you have the centurion going, oh, he just called Jesus king. Well, maybe, maybe not. It's an ambiguous term. But the way in which he talks to Jesus after using that term puts him in a position of absolute deference, though. It is a position, or it is a word that describes a relationship of authority. If I go to somebody and I'm talking to... I have a problem with this. I've been rebuked about this more than once by our academic dean. But I cannot help but call him Dr. Scott. I just do. Every time I see him, I'm like, hey, Dr. Scott, how's this going? Call me Mark. I'm like, sorry. And then I'm like, see you, Dr. Scott. You know, I can't get it. My mentor up at Lincoln, Dr. Lowry, he told me, he's like, no, call me Bob. Okay, how about no? Like, I'm not going to call you Bob. You're Dr. Lowry. And the reason why I use that term is because I'm describing a relationship that I have with that person. I don't feel worthy to call them Mark or to call him Bob. And you know what? Even if we are colleagues, I don't want to call him. I will always call him Dr. Pachauer. It's just the way I roll. Can I call him Larry? Sure, I could. But it makes me cringe calling him that. Because that doesn't communicate my relationship to him. It doesn't communicate my respect for him. And so I choose to use terms that accurately depict my relationship to someone. Whenever you use the word Lord, it does not necessarily mean that you're calling him king, but it does depict, it's a relational term. There is an act of deference that is happening here. He's saying, sir, I need your help. And in that relationship, he's saying that you're the one that deserves the respect in this moment. Do you see what I'm saying there? So just because he's not exalted him as king necessarily does not mean that there's not an exchange of relationship in that term. Okay, let's keep going. What does he ask him for? His servant is at home paralyzed and is in terrible suffering. Verse 7 would have ticked the Jewish nation off. Jesus said to him, "I will go and heal him." Why would that have made them mad?
Gentile.
He is a Gentile. What else? He is going to their home, which is a very intimate setting. Right? What else?
Would they probably not have wanted to support the Roman army?
Yeah, it's not just a Gentile. This is the leader of the army that is oppressing the nation of Israel. It's not just a Gentile. This is all that Israel hates and loathes and looks forward to the Messiah crushing when he comes. And Jesus is going to go help him? At that point, some of the leaders may have just said, he's just like the Hasmonean dynasty. He's in bed with the government. He's just like the Herodians and the Sadducees, politically liberal. This would not have been something they would have wanted their Messiah to say, because he's not come to help the enemies, according to the Jews. What has he come to do? Destroy them. To make them the subjects of his kingdom. So the fact that a servant is suffering, I think the Jews would say, good. It's probably because he's on the wrong side of the battle. Verse 8, the centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof." Now that would have ticked the Roman kingdom off. Why? There's a lot of kingdoms really mad from this exchange. Why would that have made the Roman kingdom upset? What's that? He is submitting to a Jew. He's putting the Jew in a position of honor. The Roman centurion says, "I am not worthy to have you come under the roof of my house." If the Roman centurion wanted, he didn't need to go to Jesus and say, "Oh, please, please, please help me and my servant." Because Rome was in charge, Rome would claim to be able to say, "You do what I tell you or I will kill you." That's the difference. Their empire functions off of dominance, off of conquering, off of violence. So he does not need to have any sort of deference to Jesus. He could command him to do what he wanted. And instead he looks at Jesus and he says, "I'm not even worthy to have you come under my roof." Keep reading. "But just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." What has he just shown us that this is all about? What is he just... let me rephrase that. What is the centurion just surfaced as the issue of this entire account?
Authority.
Authority. What the centurion just said is, you have authority, a lot like mine. But there's a similarity and a difference between the centurion's authority and Jesus' authority. Here is the similarity. The centurion, whenever he gives his commands for his servants to go do his beckoning, a lot of times it is in the context of battle stratagem. It is on the battlefield, he is the one that is calling the shots. He is the centurion, the leader of 100 soldiers. Whenever he makes a command, it is to in order to develop the strategy of the actual battlefield. And the same thing is very similar with Jesus. His authority is not just one that we acquiesce to because, you know, that's what you do. He'll just beat us if we don't. We obey because we are his soldiers and he is developing his strategy on the battlefield of this world. Every morning you wake up and you step out of your bed, you need to understand you are stepping onto a battlefield. We are in a war. It drives me crazy when people act like that we are not at war with another kingdom. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Seriously, I think one of the main problems with American churches today is that we've forgotten we're in a battle. And I've said this in a sermon before, but here's the way it usually goes. If Satan can convince us that we're not in a battle, then he may even be able to convince us there's not an enemy. And if there's not an enemy, you don't need a weapon. If you don't need a weapon, you'll sit it down and take a nap. And that seems to be what happens in a lot of our Christian lives. We act like that the church... You know, want to know why the church is so, you know, the ugly mother like we talked about yesterday? It's because the church is not just full of people of God. We are naive to think that Satan isn't commanding his kingdom to putting people in our churches, even in leadership, to fight his battle. Seriously. We think we're going to be so dumb as to think that his kingdom won't send spies. Honestly. I know of, for a fact, well, we just need to keep our eyes open to that. Where are we at? Authority. Okay, similarity is the fact that they're both fighting in a battle. The difference is this. The authority that he is pointing to what Jesus has is not just over people. You see the difference? He says all you need to do is say the word and he will be healed. Jesus' authority is over people, but it is over bigger than people, and that's what the centurion is pointing out. There's a major difference. He understands the concept of authority, but he doesn't understand all the authority that Jesus has. Because Jesus can even command diseases, and they do his bidding. That's pretty cool. Verse 10. When Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, before we get to what he said that they followed him, I want to point out that this is the only time in the entire book of Matthew that Jesus is ever astonished. That Jesus is ever astonished. We actually have 6 different accounts of other people or groups being astonished. Matthew chapter 8, verse 27, the disciples will be astonished when Jesus calms the storm. It's using the same Greek word. Matthew chapter 9, 33, the crowds are astonished when Jesus casts out the demon that was making the man mute. Same Greek word. Matthew 15, 31, right before the feeding of the 4,000, the crowds around the Sea of Galilee are astonished at Jesus' healings. Matthew chapter 21, 20, the disciples are astonished at the withering of the fig tree at Jesus' command, which we'll talk about the symbolic reality of that one later. Matthew 22, 22, the Pharisees are astonished at Jesus' answer to their trap about paying taxes to Caesar, which will be an awesome conversation once we get there about kingdoms. Matthew 27, 14, Pilate is astonished at Jesus' silence in the face of allegations. The only time that Jesus is astonished in the entire book of Matthew, he is astonished, ironically, at a Roman centurion and the faith that he has in Jesus' authority. There's a clash of kingdoms here, and the irony shouldn't be lost on that. He says to the people, I tell you the truth, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. Help me exegete that verse. What do you notice whenever I say that verse? What do you notice through the lens we're looking through about that's significant about that verse? Yes?
After all the offenses that you were just listing, the Jews would have had, because it says that the Romans were better.
Yeah. What? I mean, what would a Jew be hearing? You're exactly right. What would a Jew be hearing with that? Put yourself in the position of the Jew, what you're longing for, what the Romans do to your whole people group. And this guy who's doing these miraculous events, he heals a leper who was a part of the Jewish community. That guy had pretty cool faith. And yet he comes to the Roman centurion and he says, I have not found faith like this in all of Israel. If you're a Jew, what are you experiencing in that moment? I hear whisperings, but I don't hear any audible words. Shame, is that what I heard? Yeah, there'd be some shame there. And a lot of times with shame comes another emotion. Anger. You kidding me? A lot of times, if you are shamed in a position, the emotion of shame is something you really got to keep a handle on. Because whenever you're ashamed, especially publicly, your natural reaction will be to lash out in anger. That's just kind of food for thought. Because they go hand in hand. Anger. I think there'd be a feeling of being betrayed. That this guy comes to the mount claiming that there's a new kingdom. That he is the one supposedly bringing it in. He's doing miraculous things. He's preaching the kingdom of God. Even in the desert. And he comes and says that the Romans are better than us. They may have even been suspicious. Is this guy a Roman intruder? Is he a spy from the Romans? Is he kind of like Josephus 30 years earlier? I mean, who is this guy? It wouldn't have made him happy. Let's at least all agree on that. Because he's taking an oppressive regime and saying, this guy's got better faith than anybody in the regime I've come to establish a kingdom within. Let's keep moving. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus right here is pointing to some major Old Testament themes. Because what he's just talked about is the... the feast. The feast. Matter of fact, this is an important Old Testament passage that I would consider writing down. Isaiah 25, 6 through 9 describes this feast in a lot of detail. This is an eschatological feast. The eschatological meaning the feast at the end of everything, when the golden age is about to begin. This is the feast that Revelation chapter 19 describes, the supper of the Lamb, the wedding feast of the Lamb, whenever everything is over and the new creation is about to begin. That is the feast that is described in Isaiah 25. And what's significant about that is in Isaiah 25, 6 through 9, the feast is for all people. All people. Jesus says they will come from the east and the west to sit down to the feast with the patriarchs of Israel. Who is the ones that are going to be sitting down at the feast? All people that find authority in Jesus. That, again, this is not something that the Israelites liked at this point. And it's not because they didn't understand what they were supposed to be. It's because at this point in their lives, they've been so oppressed for so long that they don't want to be the light to the Gentiles. They want to burn the Gentiles. You see the difference? They don't want to hear about the eschatological feast whenever all people will come together and they will be sitting at positions of prominence with the patriarchs of Israel. They don't want to hear about that. They want to hear about the suffering of the enemy, of the enemies that Jesus has just commanded us to pray for and love. That's what they want to hear. See, this is a clash of identities, a clash of kingdoms, because they are going off of one script of the way in which the Messiah and the kingdom is supposed to be. But Jesus has come and he says, you've got the entire script wrong, let me replace it with the true script. They're going off of two totally different programs, and that's going to cause conflict because they're trying to occupy the same space at the same time. Verse 12. Now this is weird. He says that they'll take their places at the feast, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom... Now define that term, subjects of the kingdom, for me in the sociological arena. Don't think spiritual arena, think sociological. Do you know what I mean whenever I'm asking that question? In the society that the Jews and Jesus were living in, what was the definition of the subjects of the kingdom? Slaves? Yeah, what else? Think also, like, even specific terms. Who would that be referring to? What's that? The Jews? Now, the subjects of the kingdom, if I'm talking within the Jewish vernacular, the Jewish frame of reference, who would they be looking at as the subjects of their kingdom? The Romans, right? He says, but the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. What is that imagery? Yeah, that's judgment imagery. That's hell imagery. We'll get that in heavy doses once we get to Matthew 25. That's judgment imagery. Now what is he saying about the subjects of the kingdom? What is their fate? Huh? Yeah, their fate is judgment, which the Jews would have liked, right? If the subjects of the kingdom, according to their frame of reference, was the Romans, they would have loved to have heard judgment language being described, used to describe the subjects of their kingdom, the Romans, right? But how do we define subjects of the kingdom in this context that Jesus has just laid out? Now I'm not asking the sociological question, now I'm asking the textual question. How is Jesus defining subjects of the kingdom in this context? Exactly. Those that aren't submitting themselves to Jesus as the authority. And he has just got done saying that the faith in Israel has been exceeded by a Roman. This would not have made the Jews happy. I know that's a constant theme. But what I'm trying to... Remember, I told you my goal from the very beginning of this class is to trace the kingdom theme throughout the book of Matthew so that we can understand more clearly why Jesus had to be crucified. He had to be crucified politically and sociologically because of the stuff he was saying. Because the subjects of the kingdom being defined, in essence, as even the rebellious or the Jewish elite that he's not had too many kind words to say about, would have been something that would have started them to think, maybe we should kill this guy. Maybe a good idea if we're going to keep our power. Yes?
Sir, could you just clarify real quick? The subjects of the kingdom are going to be passed judgment on. So which kingdom are we talking about?
Let me write it up here because... Yeah, let me write it up here. If I'm looking from the actual political... what's the word I'm looking for? The political terrain or the political horizon of the day, the subjects of the kingdom defined by the Romans would have equaled the Jews and anybody else that wasn't in power with the Romans. I'm talking in the Jewish context because they also would have included those in Dacia. It also would have included, you know, the other subjects of the kingdom, the ones that were under the hegemony of Rome. That would have been the definition sociologically of subjects of the kingdom. Because the only kingdom that was in power at that time was the Roman kingdom, and their subjects would have been anybody that was not in power with them. The Jews, however, would have interpreted this in light of the eschatological feast that he just referred to, their kingdom feast. They would have been defining this as Romans or anybody else that was trying to claim the authority that only belonged to them. It was their enemies. But Jesus comes along and he redefines the whole paradigm. He says, no. As a matter of fact, I'm going to put Christ's kingdom. In Christ's kingdom, the subjects of the kingdom equal anyone that doesn't submit to Jesus. Submit. Do you see what's happening? We have three different definitions of subjects of the kingdom because we have multiple kingdoms trying to occupy the same space at the same time. They all claim to be in power, or they claim that they will be in power. And they all claim to be having subjects because by definition, if you're a kingdom, you have people that are under you. Does that clarify what we're doing? Okay. Any other questions on that? Yeah.
So when he said to the Gentile that no one in Israel's faith is like... has faith like this, that he's saying nobody has given me this authority, and so they're all going to judgment.
What he is saying, the word faith is the key point there. Jesus defines faith, and I think I said this yesterday, but if not, let me say it again. Faith in this context is defined as the acknowledgement and submission to Jesus' authority. That is the definition of faith. No one in all of Israel has shown this type of acknowledgement and submission to Jesus' faith in that anybody that Jesus has encountered so far. That's what he's saying. He's saying this Roman centurion gets it. You guys don't. He understands I have the authority at a word that I can command. I don't even have to go to his house. I can command for the disease to leave and it leaves. Why? Because I'm in control. And no one in all of Israel is looking at me this way. As a matter of fact, in just 2-3 chapters, we're going to have them, the key leaders of Israel, saying that you're possessed by Satan. So he is defining the word faith differently than what we normally define it as. We define it as this fluffy, cognizant, you know, oh yeah, I think Jesus is Lord. And that's all that it's defined as, which is just ludicrous. That is not the definition of faith. That is the definition of faith that has been overly influenced by the Enlightenment. It is not just a cognitive assent. Is bigger than that. It is acknowledgement and submission to the authority of Jesus, which means you acknowledge He's the one in control, and then you allow Him to be in control. So where He tells you to go, you go. When He tells you what to do, you do. That's a bigger definition of faith than what we usually function off of. That's the kind of faith that does lead to salvation. Not just going, yeah, whenever I get the theological quiz, whenever I die, I'm able to say, check mark, Jesus is Lord, and now I'm in the pearly gates. Like that, really? That's all? That's it? That's what God's looking for? Can you get the right answer to that question? I think we're reducing it a little bit. We think we're exalting it. Kind of like baptism, remember? Through our exaltation of it, we actually reduce it and make it less than what it was meant to be. Same thing with faith. Faith is bigger than just knowing the right answers on the theological exam. Is it a part of it? Sure. But that's not all that it is. It's acknowledgement and submission to Jesus' authority. And no one in all of Israel has exceeded this guy's faith. We don't have time to go into the Roman parallels to that. Because the word faith is not just a Christian word. I don't know if you guys... The word faith is not just a Christian word. It's a Roman word. It's faithfulness to the Roman Empire is something that they were constantly monitoring. The word pistis has a bigger definition than just a spiritual application. Verse 13, then Jesus said to the centurion, go, it will be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that very hour. Jesus' deeds validate his authority of his words. Keep moving. We might be catching up. Okay. When Jesus came into Peter's house, he saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand and the fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. This is what is significant to me about the way in which Jesus has moved. He's just dealt with a man with leprosy who would have been a part of the Jewish community, and that's the reason why at the end Jesus says, go show yourself to the priest, offer the gifts, so you can be reintegrated back into the Jewish kingdom. Then he comes to a centurion. He deals with that kingdom. And he says, you, too, have faith that succeeds all those in Israel. Then he comes to Peter. You almost have concentric circles. People in this kingdom, and the people that even belong to Jesus' kingdom. These are all the people that define the identity of Jesus' kingdom. Those that are following him. It doesn't matter what your ethnicity is. It doesn't matter your proximity to Jesus. You can be a follower of Jesus if you submit and acknowledge his authority. You see what's happening? Even those that have already committed, they would be in a different category of kingdom at this point than these two. And he's saying all of these can belong to me if you acknowledge and submit to my authority. Peter's mother-in-law, what does that tell us about Peter? He's married. Yeah, so sorry, priests. Verse 16. When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with the word and healed all the sick. Why is that significant? This is the fourth miracle. Why is that significant? What just happened there? Anybody? Another kingdom. What's the other kingdom? Satan. What is? Because if you notice, when the evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him. And he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. There is more than one kingdom, I listened up here yesterday, that is at war here. It's the kingdom of Satan is the primary agent behind the machinations of the Roman Empire and the Jewish Empire. And right here, Jesus confronts the kingdom of Satan as well and says, I'm going to win this. See, this is the reason why Jesus' ministry must be looked at as an all-out assault on the kingdom of Satan. This is the reason why I do believe that Jesus' ministry did bind Satan. Is because he's declaring war. He's coming around and he's saying, I'm setting everyone free. I'm even going to start casting out demons just to let you know this battle is on. And guess what? The people after me are going to be doing the same things. He's declaring war. The kingdom of Satan is not exempt. Verse 17. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. This will be on the test. He took up our infirmities, and carried our diseases. Where does that come from? 53. Isaiah 53, which that chapter, Isaiah, technically this is Isaiah 53 verse 4. But what is significant about Isaiah 53? Please. Yes. It is the most powerful, in my opinion, messianic chapter in the entire Old Testament. Where he takes on our infirmities. He suffers for us. This is the suffering servant. Where he takes upon the sins of the people onto himself. The suffering servant. But what do we notice that is different in this context of the application of this chapter and verse? What is significant? Let me read it again. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. How do we normally translate that when we're describing Isaiah 53? What? Sorrows, what else? Sins. This is the act of atonement, normally is what we apply to Isaiah 53. How is Matthew using it in this context? Huh?
Literally.
Because what did he just say? After he is healing all these people and casting out demons, after he's just healed the servant of the centurion, after he's just healed the leper, he comes in at the very end of it to summarize it. He says, this is what was fulfilling the prophet Isaiah whenever he said, he took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. Here is what Matthew was saying. And it is very appropriate that this is what the Faith Forum context is for this particular discussion. That Jesus was here to heal us of our sins, but also of our bodies. Let me just take a little bit of a side note here. Do I want to sit? No, I don't want to sit. How do I say this delicately? First, let me say this. I agreed wholeheartedly with the conclusion of yesterday's sermon. It is a both and, not an either or. It is so stupid for us to think that the gospel is only about healing people's bodies or only about healing people's souls. Seriously. Honestly. That is dumb. To think that the gospel is not both and is just simply to ignore the gospel. Like if you don't look at that your job as a Christian is to both be healing people's bodies and their souls, both, you don't understand what Jesus came and was doing. You just don't get it. The debate exhausts me. It is annoying. It is a worthless discussion. Because it's almost like we can separate who we are. I usually always look at somebody and say, listen, why don't you just tell me that I'm always supposed to teach somebody's soul or I'm always supposed to help rescue their soul by connecting them to Jesus. But only tell it to me by using your soul, don't use your body. And they're like, well, I don't even understand what that means. Yeah, me neither. I can't separate you. It makes no sense to me. Matter of fact, I was traveling in Russia, Vivert Law gave his testimony about how he came to salvation. He came to salvation because he's a fourth generation Christian living in India. And it goes back to his great-grandma. Yes, his great-grandma. Who, and I'm going to make this really short, basically had an ailment in her foot that was killing her. It was infected and everything like that. She goes to a mission group that was in India that was medically oriented. And they began, and the way Vivert Law said it, he says they began to heal her physically and spiritually. She decides to become a Christian. Her husband finds out, and at the time, we're talking in the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was very much lawful for the husband to kill his wife if she was disobeying him, and so that's what he planned to do. She found out through somebody in the community that night she was going to be killed, so she grabbed her only son, ran off to the mission, and hid away from them. While the mission was moving to another city the following day, she made it there just in time. She ends up dying that next week as they are moving to the next place. And the baby is still with the mission. The father comes looking for his baby a month later because he realized all that happened and where the baby finally was. But on his way there, miraculously somehow, and I know that sounds weird me applying this, but this is the way Vivert described it, the husband died. And the baby was raised in the mission, and that baby that was raised in the mission is now responsible for the generation of the laws, including Ajay Law, that is sweeping India and saving thousands of people in the name of Christ today. All because someone refused to separate their body and their soul. It's both. And let me say this. Now, here's... We need to be very careful whenever we describe something that there is over 2,000 passages in the Bible discussing where God is commanding, demanding, and absolutely exhorting His people to be involved in, aka social justice. We'd be very careful labeling something like that as a flavor of the month. Do you hear what I'm saying by that? Because my question is this. If the church is just now waking up to the reality that we should have been social justice for a long time from now, I don't consider that a fad. I consider it a revival. Big difference. It is not just a trend that is moving. It is about our very identity. For they will know us by the way we love one another. For when Jesus in Matthew 25 is discussing social justice issues, it's a matter of judgment. And both groups in Matthew 25 are shocked when Jesus looks at him and he says, "You didn't feed, clothe me, go to hell." And they're like, "What? How, when did we even see you?" And when the group, he looks at them and he says, "You guys did feed me, you clothed me, you get to go to eternal bliss, you inherit the kingdom of heaven." They say, "When did we even see you?" The point is, it's so much a part of who they are as an identity, they're people, that they didn't even know that that's what they were supposed to be doing because that's just what they do. Social justice is not a fad. It's something the church has disregarded. It is the primary way that we evangelize for the first 400 years of the gospel. Look it up in history. As a matter of fact, this verse is quoted by the early church fathers when they were describing the plagues that were wiping out literally hundreds of thousands of people in the Roman Empire. And this is the verse that describes what the Christians were doing, because the Christians were taking the people that were being thrown out by their families because they had the plague. They were taking these people, nursing them back to health, and in them nursing them back to health, Christians were dying in their place. And one of the church fathers says, well, what they're doing is this. They are taking up the infirmities of their enemies, and they're carrying their diseases and dying in their stead. You have to be able to answer the question, how did Christianity explode in the first 400 years from a small sect into the national religion in 325? 1 John, all of the church history says the way they did it is by loving people better than anybody else. It is idiotic to think that we can separate preaching the gospel and loving the least of these, and vice versa. The church is not just a cool red cross. We don't just bring healing to the body. We bring healing to the soul. And that's the reason why, you know what I think is really hilarious about this? I read an article in December of 2009 in the, I believe it's the New York Times, but it was the division from the United Kingdom New York Times, go figure. This guy by the name of Matthew Paris, the title of his article is, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe That Africa Needs God." And his whole argument is that as a kid growing up in Africa, he said, I always knew whenever I was interacting with Christians because they were different. And he says, what Africa needs is not just more Red Cross workings. What they need is an entire transplant of faith. He says, because these people are being healed, but they still walk away with no hope. And he says, I am not a Christian, don't claim to be a Christian. He says, but if Christians don't get serious about Africa, the entire generation will be lost. And I remember reading that article going, yes. And I remember reading the article going, are you kidding me? That we have to listen to an atheist to call us to the mission that Jesus has been demanding us to do for 2,000 years? That he understands that we have to offer better than we do? It's not a matter of doing something like a command. It's not a matter of finding something that's just a new cool thing to do. This is who we are. This is the identity of the kingdom of God. And if you don't want to do it, then you need to find another kingdom. Because it's both and, whether you like it or not. Okay, sorry about that. Moving on. Verse 18, we're going back to the Word. When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Whoa, what is significant about that? And what is the teacher of the law saying? Huh? Yeah, he's saying, I'll follow you. That's pretty huge. Because at this point, Jesus and John the Baptist have had nothing to say but nasty stuff about the teachers of the law, right? Remember in Matthew chapter 3, what does John the Baptist say about the teachers of the law? The Pharisees and Sadducees come to him and he says, "You brood of vipers. Who told you that the kingdom was going to be established?" And then he goes on and just rips them. Why? Because they weren't producing fruit. Does that have any connection to the conversation we just had? He gets really upset. He says, "You're not producing fruit." What fruit? Matthew 23 is how Jesus defines the fruit. He says, "You're neglecting the most important things of the law: truth, justice, and mercy." Or no, I'm sorry. That's not even right. mercy, justice, and faithfulness. I added that one. Anyway, teachers of the law are now coming to Jesus saying, yeah, we'll buy into this. This shouldn't surprise us. John chapter 3, Nicodemus is a Pharisee. He comes to Jesus in faith. Even though it was by night, but that's another issue for John's class. Verse 20, Jesus replied, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Here's, let me go ahead and just finish reading this. Another disciple, no, I can't. Verse 20, here's the interaction that is happening with Jesus and this teacher of the law. Teacher of the law is coming because at this point we only know of four disciples that Jesus has called, right? Right now, we have Peter, Andrew, James, and John. That comes from Matthew chapter 4. We will get Matthew himself in chapter 9, and then we realize he has another, you know, however many, seven more once we get to chapter 10. But at this point, Jesus is still in somewhat collecting disciples. And the traditional way of doing it in the Jewish culture was that a student would come and they would seek out the rabbi. They would seek out the rabbi. Jesus flips this by going around and calling out his own. But this guy's coming and doing the traditional thing. I want to follow wherever you go. Now, if Jesus is the Messiah and this guy thinks Jesus is the Messiah, where does he think Jesus will ultimately be going? What location? Jerusalem. Why? Because that's where the Messiah is going to be ruling as he kicks all the enemy's tails. Yeah? But what does Jesus tell him? I don't have a location. My kingdom isn't attached to a geography. My kingdom is transgeographical. My kingdom is transgenerational. And then he uses the word Son of Man. There are two possible references for this, and this is how we're going to end class today. Turn to Daniel chapter 7, because that's the only one I really think matters. The other one is Ezekiel. Son of Man is used 90-some-odd times. And it's used to describe the frailty of Ezekiel in comparison to God himself. But the most significant Son of Man reference in all the Old Testament is Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 through 14. What has happened at the beginning of Daniel chapter 7? Hear this very carefully, because the context is very important. What has happened at the beginning is Daniel has seen a vision of four kingdoms, four beasts that are emerging out of the sea. And that'll be important for the very next miracle that happens. They emerge out of the sea. And the fourth kingdom, some scholars will disagree with this, but I disagree with them. They will say that it's the Greek Empire, but I argue it's the Roman Empire. And the reason why they argue that's Greek Empire is because they have something against prophecy, because Daniel could have possibly been writing 600 years previous, but they want to argue that he was writing in the 2nd century BC. Bottom line is, fourth empire that comes out is the Roman Empire. After all that happens, he sees the beast, he's really nasty, da-da-da-da. Verse 13 happens. Daniel says, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. First of all, I wanted you to ask this question because this will be important later. He is coming on the clouds. The one like a Son of Man is coming on the clouds. But where is he coming to? Where is he coming from? We usually interpret it as from earth, or I mean from heaven to earth. But in context, he's coming from earth to heaven. Because why? Coming on the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. Where is the Ancient of Days? Heaven. Verse 14. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Why did Jesus just use the Son of Man terminology? Huh? He's describing his kingdom. It is not attached to a location. It's transgeographical, it's transgenerational. But it has a program, and it's one that's different than what Rome has to offer. Really quick, the last... No, we can't do that. Verse 21, we'll start tomorrow. All right, love you guys. See you in the morning.